I just described would be if E is at 12 o'clock and H is at 3 o'clock and my body is aimed to the north, I would be transmitting a signal to the north, and the magnitude of that E and that H, the ratio between the two, by the way, is related to the 377 ohm impedance of free space. And so if I knew the magnitude of either the E or the H, I know the signal strength, I know the direction of propagation, and in theory, from what I just described, there would be no signal propagating to the south. That signal would propagate to the north only. And that TEM wave I just described, transverse electromagnetic wave, operates that way in free space, and it operates in an extremely similar manner within a piece of coaxial cable. Over to you, West, T2RAW.
You're actually opening a box of Pandora's. You actually explained TM mode. If I'm correct, if you put a magnetic operator in the horizontal plane, in the interface, that's what propagates. Do you agree? And to agree?
Yeah, we're in a sticky area right now, Wes. It is my belief that the strength of the magnetic field within the transmitting antenna is what initiates the transmitting process. And if you analyze most of the computer modeling programs that will predict for you pattern and polarization and standing wave ratio and all those other properties, they use finite element analysis, break up the antenna into small little chunks. They carefully calculate the amount of current flowing each of those chunks. The amount of current flowing in each chunk determines how strong is the local magnetic field. And out at a point in free space, they add up all those individual magnetic fields at that distance with that geometry, add them all in a vector manner to figure out what is the strength of the signal in that manner. So magnetics seems to initiate the process. And all waves that are propagating in free space are TEM, transverse electromagnetic. You can get a so-called transverse electric or a transverse magnetic wave, but only inside of a piece of waveguide. In free space, you cannot do that. Every free space wave in a normal uniform medium is TEM with a very fixed ratio between the E and the H. Over to you, Roy. I mean, Wes, K2RAW.
I must absolutely agree with you. I was saying about the interface. And the interface is your waveguide. When you have a lossy medium, which is air, and when you have a conducting medium... No, I'm sorry. When you have a conducting lossy medium, which is earth, and then you have the dielectric medium, which is... or medium that is different in properties, which is air. Now you have that interface. And the way it propagates is that magnetic component is horizontal and the electric component is vertical. So now, if you have that interface or if you compare it to any other waveguide, then the magnetic component at this particular situation is TM mode, right or wrong?
I'm going to answer that directly in a way that gives a little bit of a picture. Assuming I've got a piece of ordinary rectangular waveguide on the table with the broad wall flat on the table. That piece of waveguide used in the normal manner will be transmitting a transverse electric wave, TE wave. If you analyze the TE wave, you'll find out that it has a magnetic component in the Z direction, but it has no electric component in the Z direction. The electric component is only straight up and down, perpendicular to the table. Could analyze it that way with a set of mathematics, and that's the way it's conventionally taught. Another way of looking at it is that the real TEM wave that entered the piece of waveguide, launched by the waveguide to coax adapter in the usual case, zigzags down the waveguide. It bounces back and forth, zigzags, bouncing across the vertical, narrow walls. And there is a wave bouncing left and right, and there's a wave bouncing right and left at each location, like a pair of scissors. If you kept track of the direction of propagation of the two bouncing waves, it would look like a pair of scissors that are opened at a particular angle, and that angle is an exact angle between the zigzag waves determined by the dimensions of the waveguide and the wavelength you're operating at. For the normal dominant mode of the waveguide, there is an exact angle, no other angle, at which the signal will bounce down the waveguide. So because it is a TEM wave bouncing left and right, and a TEM wave bouncing right and left, they add up in such a way that there is a magnetic component in the direction of propagation, but no electric component. So you can analyze it as zigzags, and some books do, or you can analyze it as a so-called pure TE wave. And there's all kinds of crazy equations to try to settle all of this, but the zigzagging TEM wave, to me, makes a lot more sense. And it gives me a little bit more of an understanding of what waveguide beyond cutoff, what that word really means. Over to US, K2IW.
Two last questions. When you have the electric component up vertically and the magnetic component is horizontal, in omnidirectional antenna that is actually making a cylindrical wave, what is the circular wavefront? And what is the direction of circular wavefront?
A vertical ground plane antenna has an E field that's purely vertical, and in the near field, the magnetic field is curling around that antenna. So the magnetic field looks like it is a curved wavefront, and the E field doesn't in the near field. As soon as you get a couple of wavelengths away from that vertical ground plane antenna, it becomes a pure TEM wave. That's the only thing Mother Nature will let you propagate. So in the reactive near field, you can measure all kinds of curved magnetic fields and slightly curved electric fields out of that particular antenna. But that's just the local characteristics. And if you started measuring signal strength versus distance, when you're in the far field, it will obey the inverse square law. Every time you double the distance, you'll get one quarter the signal strength in watts per square meter. Or you'll get, every time you double the distance, you'll get half the E field or half the H field. And so in the far field, it's like that. But when you're in the reactive near field, very close to the antenna, it doesn't obey inverse square law anymore. It's inverse third, fourth, and fifth law. And the E and H don't have the right relationships to each other. So making measurements in the very near field of the antenna, when you have enough knowledge, the way it behaves is predictable, but it's not simple. Over to you, Wes, K2IW.
Thank you very much. I took so much time. And the last part of the question is, actually it's not a question. It's a statement that it needs to be verified by you. Forget about the near field. In far field, the wavefront looks like more open spherical surfaces that expand. So by that, we could cut the piece of rectangle from it, and for every period it appears to be parallel to each other, now you have a images of the wavefront that are perpendicular to the direction of the propagation. Yes or no?
In the example I gave earlier, if your eyes operated at radio frequencies, and if you could slow down time, and you watched the signal coming away from your antenna, it would look like a series of bubbles that are expanding. Each of those bubbles, you can trace the E field and the H field, and they go around the complete surface of that bubble, the complete circles. When you're in the far field, where the section of the signal you're looking at, the wavefront, looks like it's flat, E looks like it goes in the vertically polarized signal. It looks like it goes to positive infinity and negative infinity. And the H looks like it goes to infinity to the left and to the right. In reality, those wavefronts do somewhat go all the way around the bubble and they cancel. But the bubble is now so big, you almost don't know that. But those are, what's the word for it now? They are continuous lines that are closed. The E field lines and the H field lines really are closed if you allow the infinite viewpoint of what you're looking at. If you cut off that chunk of wave by passing it through an aperture, it now becomes a brand new spherical wavefront. It's not planar anymore. If I had a great big flat metallic wall with a square hole of 1 square meter in that wall, and my signal, my planar wavefront that started off at infinity, comes up to my wall and now propagates through my 1 square meter hole. That new signal coming out of that hole has a brand new set of spherical wavefronts until you get into the to the far field from that hole. So your method of trying to cut off those lines that go to infinity up and down in E and left and right in H, you try to cut those off, you're generating a brand new wave and you're disturbing it. Mother Nature doesn't like that. She's going to give you all kinds of new characteristics when you do that. So that signal coming through your square meter hole is no longer a planar wavefront. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Thank you very much. How would you picture cylindrical wave?
Okay. Cylindrical wave, nice sounding words, in the far field, it does not exist. Every wave in the far field is a planar wavefront. Up real close to that ground plane antenna, you could think you've got a cylindrical magnetic field and a linear E field. That's a simplistic way of looking at it. That's not the way it really propagates. In the far field, it's got a planar wave. In the far field, there is no cylindrical wave. Over to you, Wes.
Where did you get it from? The Bessel function?
What do you mean, where do you get it from? You didn't get it from anywhere. It doesn't exist. In the far field signal, a TEM signal, there is no cylindrical signal. It's got a planar wavefront. Over to you.
Thank you very much for that explanation. No, I was asking, but excuse my incorrect language. What equation was taken for that? I'm trying to find out where the calculation came from. Was it Laplacian simplifying, or was it coming from Maxwell equation? I'm trying to find out how that was found.
It wasn't found. It doesn't exist. Now, when you talk about a cylindrical wave, that could be an overly simplistic way of trying to describe a circular polarized wave. Maybe you mean circular polarization when you talk about cylindrical. But if you're talking about linear polarization, there is no cylindrical wave. Over to you, Wes.
Well, we're talking about the cylindrical coordinates with angular and azimuthal symmetry, right?
If you do a good job of explaining a wave in the far field, you use spherical coordinates. And if you're smart enough, you can use linear coordinates, Cartesian coordinates. If you wanted to, for certain kinds of problems, you can force it into a set of cylindrical coordinates. It is not often done that way. Almost all antennas are analyzed with spherical coordinate system. Over to you, Wes.
Okay, but consider an isotropic wave propagating outward from the central point. In the near field, it would exist, right?
You could think you're seeing something you call cylindrical in the near field, in the so-called reactive near field. But that's not the way it really propagates. So, to use that method of analysis, it might work in the near field, if you force it. It's not the canonical way of doing it. Over to you, Wes.
Thank you very much for your explanation. Dr. Roy.
Okay, Wesley, so you got your answer for tonight. The big takeaway for the rest of the crowd, possibly, is that although wavefronts are linear propagation, that electromagnetic waves are linear propagation. That doesn't mean that they're linear waves. They're transverse waves that propagate in a linear fashion, which is a different thing.
When you say linear fashion, I think you're saying if I analyze only the E field in units of volts per meter, yes, they appear to be linear. Double the distance, you get half the magnitude of E field in volts per meter. Quadruple the distance, you get one quarter. So E field analyzed all by itself, or H field all by itself, appears to be linear. But if you're now talking about energy, the real power, it's inverse square law in watts per square meter, so to speak, which is really E cross multiplied with H And when you double the distance, E got to half, and the H got to half, and the E crossed H is the 1/4. So you get 1/4 the power when you double the distance. So it's square law in power. It's linear in individual magnitudes of E and H. Maybe that's what you're saying, Roy, ACQGSK2RIW.
I'm alluding to the pointer vector, which is basically at right angles to the electric and the magnetic field, and it just goes straight out. It spreads out in three-dimensional space, and because of that, that's why the inverse square rule works. If you take a section off of a sphere and you increase the radius by 2, the surface area goes up by 4, and so the same amount of energy contained in the smaller surface of that section of the sphere is now spread out to a wider section. But I would assume you would call this a longitudinal propagation as opposed to a transverse propagation, which is a transverse wave, which is seen by the electric and the magnetic wave excitation.
I'm not going to comment on that. I'm just going to listen.
Okay, Dick. That's just my 2 cents, but then what do I know? I'm not an electrical engineer.
You started saying it correctly when you said you doubled the radius of the sphere. The little spot of area you were analyzing in the small sphere becomes 4 times the area on the larger sphere that's doubled the radius. Therefore, you get 1/4 the power. You didn't put those 3 sentences together like that, so therefore I wasn't quite sure what you were saying when you said it's linear. As far as area is concerned, it's square law versus radius. Power goes down as square law of distance or square law of radius. But if you consider the E all by itself or the H all by itself, they go down in a linear manner. Double the distance, you get half the amount of E. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, when I'm speaking of propagation, I'm pretty much primarily speaking about the pointing vector, which has that the 1 over R square decay.
I agree. And the pointing vector, you determine the magnitude and the direction of the pointing vector by doing a vector cross product called E crossed H. You could make believe that your hand is, your thumb is pointing in the positive Z direction. Your fingers start off aiming straight up in the air at 12 o'clock. You rotate your hand from 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock. You're rotating from E to H in this vertically polarized wave. That tells you something about the direction of rotation of a ordinary clockwise turning of a screw and the direction of propagation. So it's one way of explaining it. It's not the only way. Over to you, Roy.
Very good, Dick. And I appreciate that you brought up cross and dot products this early so that my puzzle won't seem that kind of in blue sky. So we're going to kind of pick up on that topic a little bit for the puzzler question.
Dr. Roy, would you be able to direct me or save that part of conversation so I can have it in recording? It's excellent.
Wesley, as Dick often says, mic number one, records all these things. He has them by the end of the week. If he doesn't have them, if something hiccups, I record them. And if you want, I'll send you my copy. But he also puts an archive up, and I kind of the belt and suspenders him occasionally, the radio hiccups in New Jersey. But you can either get it with amateurradio.tv, or if you want, I could email you a copy.
Yeah, email me your copy. Maybe it's going to be better quality. I do appreciate it. Thank you very much, Dick. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy.
Okay, thanks, Wesley. Once again, I'll just kind of shout out if anyone has any other questions or comments or what have you before I start my thing, feel free. Okay, very well. A few weeks ago, we had what I thought was a great conversation about all the number lines that mathematicians use. We talked about the natural number line, the integer number line, the rational number line, those numbers that can be divided by whole that are ratios of whole numbers, and the irrational number line, those numbers that go on and on and on and don't repeat and never end, like pi and Euler's constant. So I was curious to know if anyone noticed that we actually left off one very important number line from our discussion. So for tonight's little micro puzzle, and, you know, you could have it last longer or shorter, depends on how interested you are, what kind of numbers did I fail to include in my discussion a couple of weeks ago?
K2NVB.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, I think you failed to mention the imaginary numbers, or, you know, complex numbers, which are combinations of imaginary and real numbers, I think, or multiples. Anyway, yeah, imaginary complex numbers. That's my answer.
Okay, Bob, you're very clever, and you're too clever for me. Yes, it was imaginary numbers. It wouldn't really add that much to the conversation about infinities, because it complex numbers depend upon which group of complex numbers. If they're complex numbers that are all rational, then it's in the lowest order of infinities. And if it was complex numbers that include irrational numbers, then it would be in the higher infinities that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. The interesting thing is about the whole concept of the imaginary number line. And the thing is that mathematics had a big problem in that it had equations where it didn't quite know how to handle things. Because every so often there was a solution to a problem that looked like a square root of a minus number. And if anyone's done any math, you know that most real numbers, which are the numbers other than the imaginary numbers, if you take the square, they're positive. You can't really square the same number and have it negative. So there was a lot of problems back in the 16th century just among theoretical mathematicians of trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And they finally came up with this clever little gag where they use a different axis entirely. They were using the Cartesian coordinates of Descartes. And so they use the x for the real numbers. They use the y for the imaginary numbers. And so they were able to scale a complex number, which is a component of the imaginary and the real numbers, into a complex number. Complex does not mean that it's confusing and takes a lot of time to figure out. It means it's a combination of things. So it's a combination of real and imaginary. And a very clever guy by the name of Oliver Heaviside figured out in the 18th century that this was a great way to do electronics, and we do it to this day. When we're talking about the complex impedance of some antenna or what have you, a lot of times we will not only give it in the absolute ohms, but we will give it in the amount of pure resistance and pure reactance, and along with that, the phase angle. Let me drop for a sec. Matter of fact, one of the first technets that I heard on an archive once was from Mel, K2KEY, where he actually showed people how to calculate a complex impedance by using the Pythagorean theorem. Because if you think about it, the x-coordinate of a Cartesian is the real resistance. The y-coordinate is the unreal, imaginary reactance. The positive reactance is from an inductor. Negative reactance is for a capacitor. And if you then connect the sides of the right angle, the hypotenuse will give you the absolute impedance, and the angle that it makes will give you the phase angle. So he tried to teach that many, many years ago. I think it was back in 2010 or 29 or something. So that's a complex impedance. Now, for the audience, if you have any curiosity, do you think there's something even more complex than complex numbers?
BDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
The only thing I've heard mentioned is something called a tensor, but where it could be multidimensional. Go ahead.
My 2H.
Yes, Lou.
All right, so I hope you heard our nickel link, because this is the link. but otherwise, quaternions is another axis. And don't forget to tell them about the magical number I, that you can square and get a negative answer, a minus one.
But I think you could add a third dimension, which would be time. A real radio signal is a complex signal on a Cartesian coordinate system. It's got an X component, it's got a Y component, and both of those are changing in a cyclic manner in time, depending on the frequency. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, well, Lou kind of gave the cat out of the bag. The magic for imaginary numbers is the principal imaginary number is given the designation I. And I is such that when you square I, the answer is minus one, which if you try and figure it in your head, you'll just get a headache. So in the number line, where on the x-axis is a 1 on the right and a minus 1 on the left, on the top at the same distance, if it's scaled the same, is positive I, and the bottom is negative I. When you multiply, you're basically rotating across the Cartesian surface. So you go from minus 1, from I to minus 1 when you're multiplying I, and then when you multiply by minus I by I again, you get minus I, and then when you multiply minus I by I again, you get 1. So, you know, it's an interesting, I is interesting. The slight problem is that when Heaviside came up with using this for electronics, there were so many things in electronics and Maxwell's theory. He was a big guy in the field. He kind of clarified Maxwell's theory. He actually patented the first coaxial cable and figured out that a wire with an impedance works better than just a straight wire with no impedance. He was a clever guy. He decided there were too many I's around, so he decided to use J instead, which is why in electronic engineering and when we look at a circuit, you never see anything with an I. It's usually, it's A plus BR, BJ. So that's usually how the reactance is recorded on your antenna analyzer or your vector network analyzer as a J, not an I. But, you know, mathematicians being mathematicians, they always look for the next weird thing going on. And once they kind of figured out imaginary number lines, they look to see if they could kick it up one dimension. Now, unfortunately, you know, as Dick mentioned, time. Unfortunately, though, if you do that, if you somehow, if you do an equation, say, that a hyper-complex number, that's A plus BI plus CJ. So now you have two different imaginary numbers. You can't do any math, unfortunately. They tried to do all the mathematical operators, and everything broke, and nothing worked. But they added another imaginary number. So it's A plus BI plus CJ plus DK. So there's I, J, and K. That actually you can do mathematics with. And that's what Lou is talking about. They're called quaternions. And back in the 1800s, Heaviside really wanted to use quaternions to do what Dick was mentioning about dot and cross products, because quaternions are interesting. The equation that I said, A plus BI, CJ, and DK, can be broken up into two things. The A is usually was called the scalar, and the BI plus CJ plus DK were called vectors. And so quaternions is just a more sophisticated way of dealing with three-dimensional vectors. So Heaviside wanted to continue with that, and unfortunately he lost because people liked, for some odd reason, matrix math, and they loved vectors and the cross products. So the reason why we're using cross products is because Heaviside kind of lost that deal. Meanwhile, if you have a cell phone, find it very important to know where they are in three-dimensional space, and quaternions are very, very efficient in being able to figure how a three-dimensional object is rotating through space. So your cell phone is working on quaternions, which computers love. They do it very well. So what Dick was mentioning, the dots and the cross products, are an approximation that at times kind of falls apart related to quaternions. So that's the story with quaternions. Let me drop for a second, then I'll add an additional little nuance.
VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
The I, J, and K, these are just unit vectors in the three-dimensional space. You don't mean I, J, and K together, their product is minus one or anything like that, do you?
Well, I don't remember. There's all kinds of very esoteric ways of, if you multiply I times J, you get minus K or something. I forget. It's a very convoluted sort of way, but it's a little bit more sophisticated than simply three right angle axes in a three-dimensional graph. That's sort of what it kind of falls into when you're doing matrix math and doing dot products and cross products, but the more theoretical nature of quaternions is a little bit more esoteric.
I think they sometimes call that matrix math, Roy.
Matrix math is the substitute for quaternions. Matrix math is what is ultimately what you're doing when you're doing cross and dot products of vectors. This is a little bit different. This doesn't entail matrix math. It entails other types of math. Again, that computers are a little bit better than human beings are. So in the 18th century, they all went for regular vector mathematics.
Roy, in this case, what does the A represent? If I, J, and K are those vectors, then what does the A represent there?
I guess A would be the scalar quantity if you collapse the other three-dimensional aspects of the function.
I've sometimes seen it as A sub I plus B sub J and C sub K. A, B, and C are the magnitudes. I, J, and K are the unit vectors in those three orthogonal directions. That's one way I've seen it represented. Over to you, Roy.
That's a description of purely the vector portion of the quaternions. The quaternions have four terms. The A term, and you know, I guess theoretically, if you want to get rid of the scalar term and get rid of A, you can then reuse it for AI, BJ, CK. But originally, if you look up quaternions, they'll give you this lovely little equation where it's A plus BI plus CJ plus DK. But what they did was they lopped off the scalar part. They were more interested in the vector portion of the quaternions, and then they simplified it into matrix math. So if you think matrix math is bad, that was a simplification. Anyway, their mathematicians never sleep, so obviously they said, aha, we found that a complex number of two terms worked, one with four terms worked. What about five or six or seven or eight? Well, they found that five terms and six terms and seven terms don't work. Again, the laws of mathematics, the operators don't quite work with it. They found actually that an eight-term version of this works mathematically. They don't know if it has any relationship to reality, as theoretical mathematics tends to be like, but they put it in their bag of tricks, and who knows, maybe some kind of esoteric supersymmetry group theory type of thing, they'll be able to pull it out and come out with a eight-term. They're called octonions. Quaternions are with us all day. They're in our cell phones. They're in computer programs. They're excellent at being able to rotate and change things in three-dimensional space and keep track of it. Whereas matrix math sort of does that, but there are little gotchas in matrix math where it's not quite as accurate as quaternions are. So that's the imaginary number line and all those things that come up. So when you're looking at your impedance of an antenna, at least you know a bit of the history involved in coming to a complex number like that. Any questions or comments, or I'll move on to the next subject.
One last comment, Roy, and that is, if I take a complex number, which has got a on a Cartesian coordinate system, the real is the x-axis, horizontal, and the imaginary is the vertical axis, the positive for inductive and negative for capacitive. And if I took, for instance, if my quantity happened to be one resistance of unity and an imaginary inductance of unity, I got one R plus one J or one I, if you want to call it, that would represent a dot at a 45 degree angle up from the origin. That dot represents that particular one I plus one J, or one real plus one imaginary. That dot is a single point. It could be represented that way, or it could be represented as a vector that starts off at the origin and goes to that point. But what I'm getting at is that that complex number that I just described is one single number. It happens to have two components, an imaginary component plus a real component, but at that instant of time, it is one single number. Sometimes that analysis helps understand what's happening with other kinds of radio signals. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Well, again, it becomes more of a case of semantics. It's a complex two-dimensional number. You can either describe it as an absolute value and a phase angle, or you can give it as its components in the imaginary or reactance and real resistance values. And you can denote the complex impedance by a line. If you took a line at one in the y coordinate, y coordinate, one in the x coordinate, and drew a line connecting the two, the length of that line would be the absolute value of the complex impedance, and the angle that it made could be the phase angle, and you can move that around so that it's pointing out at the origin of the Cartesian coordinates that you have. But I always think of it as a two-dimensional number, because even if you give a total absolute impedance, usually someone might want to know the phase angle. So that's where the other aspect of it falls into place.
If I drew a line from the origin to the dot that I described, and I now measure the angle between that line and the x-axis, I could call that the phase angle. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, exactly. But if you told someone the absolute length of the line without telling them the angle that it makes, you're not telling them everything. You're just telling them roughly that the absolute impedance is a certain value in ohms, but you're not telling them the phase angle, which some people would like to know.
Yeah, the absolute value would allow me to calculate the magnitude of the standing wave ratio, but I really need more information like phase angle or the relative amount of imaginary and real in order to calculate what's going to happen when that signal propagates through a known length of transmission line, for instance. Over to you, Roy.
Exactly, and that's why complex numbers are inherently two-dimensional numbers. The number lines, for the most part, that we're used to are one-dimensional. The number line of rational numbers just goes through a straight x coordinate, and you don't need to go anywhere else. But complex numbers are complex because they're made up of real and imaginary, and that means they exist in an interesting two-dimensional space where you have to either define the two values at right angles to each other, or the absolute value and the phase angle that it produces.
And by the way, complex numbers can also be natural numbers, integer numbers, rational numbers, and irrational numbers. They can have rational, irrational components of a complex number. So there's some weird combinations there are possible, right?
Yes, and complex numbers can actually be just real numbers, because within the set of complex numbers, it's possible to have something where the equation is, A plus BI or BJ, where B is zero. So it falls into real numbers. So the number of complex numbers include the real numbers and everything else. That's why last time when we were talking about different types of infinity, I didn't bother to mention imaginary numbers because it doesn't really add anything. You're in the same situation. If your imaginary number includes an irrational aspect, then it's in a larger infinity than if it has only irrational values. There was a question a couple of weeks ago when I did the infinities about multidimensional aspects, and I actually looked it up to make sure. And indeed, if you do the set of, say, rational numbers in a infinite dimensional frame, well, not an infinite, but a high dimensional frame, you know, fourth dimension, eighth dimensions, 12 dimensions, it's still alpha naught. It's still the lowest order of infinity. It's when you jump from rational to irrational numbers where the set of infinite numbers skyrockets.
Oh, VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, as Dick mentioned before there, sometimes it is better to work in the rectangular form or the polar form, but there's also sometimes you can use the exponential form of the complex numbers. It can help you to work out some things. Go ahead.
This is primarily for the human mind to figure out. There are tools and there are ways of distorting different coordinate systems to make it easier for people to see what's going on. And one of the primary examples for this, especially in electrical engineering, is the Smith chart, which makes sense if you know about admittance and all kinds of interesting inversions of the concepts of resistance and impedance and reactance and such. But confounds the average guy. I am perpetually trying to figure out a nice article to explain normalization, let alone the rest of how Smith charts work. But yeah, there's a lot of different ways that you can tweak charts or distort the coordinate systems to make it a little bit easier on our brains to figure out what's going on.
You know, one thing I had a hard time with was trying to work out J to the J power. And you can't do it too much in polar form or rectangular form, but when you write it in exponential form, it becomes more or less obvious, and you can see that it's real. Okay,
I'll bite. What's J to the J power? Well, but it depends on what J is, though, right? I assume you're using J like they used to use I. So it's the square root. The square root of minus one. So what's the square root of minus one to the square root of minus one's power?
So you get e to the minus pi over two. So it turns out to be real.
Okay, very good. And that brings Euler's constant, which is loads of fun. And one of the transcendental irrational numbers that I mentioned a while ago. Euler's number is incredibly useful. Euler's number, this is one of the many interesting things about Euler's number, if you know calculus, is that the differential of Euler's number is still Euler's number.
It's also used like in decay equations, right?
Lou. Euler's number really shows up a lot of times. And hopefully everyone's learned to call it Euler instead of Euler. I've heard both, but I think he called it Euler. Anyway, any other comments, questions, answers, statements, what have you, before I move on to the next topic? Okay, Doc. Vitamin E might make lung cancer spread faster. Researchers have known for a while that certain antioxidants seem to increase cancer risk. Ever since a 1996 clinical trial had to be halted after patients receiving beta-carotene had markedly higher lung cancer rates. Now a new study in the journal Cell has figured out exactly how antioxidants, which most of us think are supposed to be healthy, could contribute to cancer risk. By now everyone has heard the pitch on the miracle that is antioxidants. Antioxidants help fight free radicals. And what are free radicals, you might ask? Well, they're bad, and that's all you really need to know about it. Except, of course, that it's not all you need to know about it, because antioxidants and free radicals are a lot more complicated than most people ever realized. When researchers first brought them to the public attention in the 1990s, it was because early evidence suggested that free radicals contribute to everything from hardened arteries to cancer. More importantly, people who ate low levels of antioxidants seemed to be at a higher risk of developing these same conditions. The food and supplement industry took the early research and ran with it. We needed more antioxidants in our lives. But since the 1990s, the actual scientific evidence about antioxidants hasn't been nearly as cut and dry as cereal boxes might lead you to believe in. In a lot of cases, yeah, antioxidants are a positive contribution to your diet, but in some cases, too many can actually cause the very diseases we're trying to prevent. An antioxidant, at least when we're referring to the nutritional side of things, is any molecule that can act as an electron donor. A free radical is just any molecule with a lone electron on its outer electron shell. Sometimes something happens that takes an electron away from its partner. That's how you get a free radical. It's just an atom or a molecule with a lone rogue electron. The problem is that solitary electrons are incredibly reactive because they're constantly trying to get another electron to come and join them. They'll do anything to get a buddy, which means free radicals can do a lot of damage inside your body. Stealing electrons from other molecules, whether they be DNA or proteins, alters these structures and therefore alters their function. Let me drop for a second. Antioxidants perform the crucial function of donating an electron to a free radical, effectively neutralizing it. Now, we quite literally die without them, but here's the thing, we die without free radicals as well. Sometimes your body has to kill things. Most of these things are bacteria, viruses, and other invaders, but sometimes it also has to take out some of your own cells. As they divide, cells accumulate mutations and can start to act rather funny. Ideally, before they turn into something serious like cancer, your body kills them. The ways in which your immune system attacks both its own cells and foreign microbes are usually varied, but free radicals are one weapon in that arsenal. Your immune system is essentially harnessing their destructive power for good. When you get a cut on your finger, one crucial step your body takes to prevent infection is to produce more free radicals in that area. Almost all inflammation in your body involves free radical production, which is one reason that chronic inflammation can lead to a variety of diseases, especially cancer. Over time, that exposure to DNA-damaging molecules results in mutations, and those mutations can accumulate to make a cell cancerous. But in small dosages, free radicals are crucial. In fact, there are inherited diseases in which people can't produce certain types of free radicals, and they're often diagnosed when young patients keep getting life-threatening infections from seemingly innocuous sources. They can't fight off the invaders effectively without these reactive molecules. Now, because you need free radicals to function properly, your body produces its own antioxidants, as well as recruiting some from your food to keep their number in check. But, crucially, it maintains a balance. A lot of marketing primes us to think that antioxidants, like water-soluble vitamins, you can't have too many, so take them just in case. Early research may suggest that, but as biologists learn more about antioxidants, it's becoming clear that more isn't necessarily better. Let me drop for a second. There's still a lot we don't understand about this field, but preliminary research suggests a few ways having too many antioxidants can hurt us. One has to do with that balance we talked about. You need a certain supply of reactive molecules in order to maintain your immune system. Plus, researchers are now realizing that some signaling pathways inside cells are only activated by free radicals. You're loading up on antioxidant supplements. You might be throwing your body out of whack and preventing it from doing its job correctly. Increasing evidence suggests that lung cancer and certain types of melanoma are actually made worse by excess antioxidants. That seems to be because free radicals are, in some way, actively protecting cells from becoming cancerous. If you've got too many antioxidants, they start interfering with those anti-tumorigenic jobs that free radicals are trying to do. Exercise also seems to rely somewhat on some free radicals to induce a little cellular stress. Preliminary studies now show that taking high levels of antioxidants interferes with the health benefits you get from exercise. We all tend to talk about free radicals and antioxidants as big groups when they're really quite diverse. There are many types of both molecules, and each seems to act in a slightly different capacity. Vitamins E and C, for instance, are antioxidants, but they seem to fill different roles in your body. So just getting more antioxidants as a broad category is kind of meaningless. What's more, you actually seem to need a mixture of antioxidants, not just more of one kind. When antioxidants donate their crucial electron, they sometimes are left with their own lonely electron. Now, they can behave like a free radical themselves. Fortunately, other antioxidants can come along to help them out. And then yet more antioxidants can help those out, and so on and so on. It's a cascade in which they can all help stabilize each other. Let me drop for a second. When antioxidants donate the crucial electron, they're sometimes, whole food contains that balance of antioxidants, but when you take a pill of, say, vitamin E, you're only getting that one molecule. That might be part of why taking supplemental forms of antioxidants doesn't seem to help prevent diseases. We know that people who eat foods rich in antioxidants tend to be healthier, which is where this whole craze came from in the first place. Part of this is undoubtedly that folks who eat a lot of fruits and vegetables also tend to have other healthy habits. Plus, those fruits and veggies are good for you for other reasons, like their high dosages of fiber and the lack of processed ingredients. But it's also true that you do need a certain supply of antioxidants, which your body is excellent at extracting from whole foods. Getting a sufficient amount from your diet is definitely an important part of staying healthy, but that doesn't mean more is better. There have been multiple huge studies examining whether antioxidant supplements was associated with decreased risk of everything from cancer to stroke to heart disease, and they pretty much all found that it didn't matter. Unless you have a deficiency in a particular antioxidant, taking a supplement doesn't help you. And in the case of lung cancer and melanoma, it could actually hurt you. Yet again, the truth is that there's no magic ingredient or behavior that will make you healthy. Eating a balanced diet and being as active as you can is the best way to lower your risk of disease. So unfortunately, an antioxidant is not a miracle pill. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Yeah,
Trixie. Yes, Wesley.
Yeah, the missing electron creates a free radical that is highly reactive. Okay, I agree with that. Then the antioxidant must donate the electron that is at the right speed. And if it's not, then it's not donating it. True or false?
False.
Go ahead. I'm listening to the explanation.
When an electron is shared from one atom or molecule to another, it doesn't have to come with the right spin. It can change its spin spontaneously if it's going into an orbital that has an opposing spin, because you can't have two electrons with the same quantum spin in the same place. But that doesn't mean that you need to conserve the spin of an electron. You can pop it, you know, plus or minus. It just that it takes a little bit of energy, but that's what these atoms are good at.
Well, that's the issue of my question, where the energy comes from. Donating is just not something that comes without loss of the energy, but then the additional energy is to reverse the spin. So there might be a situation at which antioxidant is not capable of doing so.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
So what's next? Are the researchers going to try to figure out a way to test whether or not somebody has too much vitamin E in them or not? And they'll say, well, okay, don't take any supplements, or maybe they're going to be lower. I mean, wouldn't that be the best answer, to try to figure out how much is in the person's body?
Okay, I'll answer Wes, and then I'll answer you, Paul. Wes, the reason that antioxidants work so well is because the binding energy of their electron has a greater potential energy where it is than where it's going. So it goes down in energy well, and that extra energy which drives the reaction also gives it the slight amount of energy required to flip the electron into a different spin if that's necessary. But it has to be go down in energy well in order for an antioxidant to work. That's why not everything is an antioxidant. And with Paul, I think, unfortunately, it would really be not cost-effective to... I don't even know where you would begin to manage this, because I guess you would have to take some kind of a serum level of antioxidants, and it's difficult to know how much is in the serum versus in the cell structure. It's easier for doctors generally to say, look, you actually have to listen to what I keep telling you. You have to eat a well-balanced diet. So I think that's what's going to come of it all. And people are still going to pop the occasional antioxidants. People pop all kinds of interesting pills. For the most part, they don't cause problems. So doctors just kind of say, whatever. The vitamin industry makes billions and billions and billions of dollars. And some of the products have no proof, no indication that it does anything. They usually come up with some kind of experimental evidence based on 35 people whose memory wasn't quite so bad towards the end of it. So they said, aha, this is going to help everyone with senility, and they sell $1 billion of the stuff. So unfortunately, the vitamin industry is not the most rigorous.
Yeah, question. Because you didn't answer for you. Is antioxidant in form of ions, where you have a perfect atom and then you have extra electron, so it's always activated? What keeps the energy in?
I'm not quite sure of the question, but antioxidants are not in their primary state ionized. They simply have an electron that's more mobile, that's easier to be removed from that molecule and placed on a free radical so that you neutralize it. And then, as I mentioned before, you're kind of stuck with the antioxidant then sort of acts like a free radical as well. So you need other antioxidants to neutralize it. And eventually everything kind of settles down if you have enough in the chain, in the cascade of antioxidants. But they don't start off as charged. If they did, they would be the same problem. You would have something that's a free radical.
And here we have a problem because everything is about charge.
Well, I don't know if everything is about charge. A lot of chemical reactions amount to changing, moving protons back and forth. Adenosine triphosphate is a major storage for energy for all kinds of biochemical things, and it basically takes the breakdown of something like glucose and uses it to phosphorylate a bond, and that bond is then broken and the energy is used someplace else. So, I mean, ultimately, the charges neutralize out in the vast medium of a cell, but you're more concerned with a local ion free radical that might attach itself to something like DNA and disrupt its structure and cause a mutation.
That is correct. See, the problem that I have is that if you have two atoms and then the antioxidant shell that is a donor has an electron at a certain potential, is it possible that the free radical is at an atom that has less shells? So the electrons are at lesser potential. That's why the electron that is losing the energy to jump to free radical is still perfect for that particular shell, and the energy difference is enough to reverse the spin.
Well, I think you shouldn't think of it in terms of atoms, although it's easier, because all these items, all the antioxidants are very relatively complex molecules. And so, yeah, you could either say that it's at a higher shell level, or in some way it's electronegativity, it's bound to its molecule with less energy than it would be bound to the free radical. And that's what's driving it and giving it enough energy to jump across the gap and, if necessary, rotate its spin.
Yeah, but then we have another problem, repulsion. The electron of higher energy has a higher